חברים יקרים ירשמו לערוץ, לחצו על הפעמון לקבלת התראות, יש הפתעות ודברים יפים בהמשך.
Good people genuinely think that the Jewish people are completely blind and there's a veil over their eyes and they can't see. How could a people who have produced so many Nobel Prize winners, how could a people that produced the very doctors that delivered my children be so dumb and thick-headed about the Messiah? How could you be so blind? I'm fairly certain that every person in this room knows exactly what I do. My life is devoted to helping Jews who have converted to Christianity return back to the truth and the beauty of the Jewish faith. I've been doing that for more than 40 years. There are hundreds of Christian missions here in the land of Israel that are dedicated, funded, committed, mandated to bring every single one of you to the cross, chas v'chalila. In the United States, there are well over 1,000 Christian missions that are specifically targeting Jewish people for conversion. They have a message for you. The message is, you need to accept Yeshua, Jesus, as your Messiah, and if you believe in him, you'll be saved. And if you don't, you're damned. Jews for Jesus did not invent the notion that if you believe in Jesus as your Lord and that he was risen from the grave, that you're saved. It says that explicitly in Romans chapter 10, verse 9. There is no hope for you outside of the cross. Look at your Bible. Have you ever read the book of Isaiah, Jeremiah? Ezekiel, the church claims, they insist that if you only looked at your own scripture, your own Hebrew Bible, you would come to immediately recognize that Jesus is the promised Messiah. Well, how did the church go about advancing this idea? The church had to alter the Hebrew Bible, change the text, rip passages out of context in order to portray the Hebrew Bible as speaking about the birth, life, death of Jesus. And as it turns out, this is not a typical way that a rabbi begins a lecture on the book of Isaiah chapter 7. This is very strange. It's quite possible I'm one of the few people that has ever opened a lecture on the book of Isaiah in this fashion. But tonight, these worlds are all coming together. As it turns out, the Hebrew Bible has been abused by the Gospels themselves and the letters of Paul in order to make the text appear Christological. We're going to explore that tonight, and then we're going to examine what these texts are really speaking about. It really is quite elegant. It's quite exquisite. We will use the church as a foil, I do this frequently, as a mirror to reflect back the truth and the beauty of the Jewish faith. And Isaiah chapter 7 is no doubt one of the most controversial chapters in all of Tanakh. The notion that Jesus was miraculously conceived, that he was born to a virgin, only appears in two books of the Christian Bible. It only appears in the book of Matthew and the book of Luke. And those are not the earliest books in the Christian Bible. Although the book of Matthew appears first when you open up a New Testament, it was written really quite late. If you were to read the Christian Bible in its chronological order, you would really begin with the letters of Paul. There are 13 of them. Seven of them, we are certain, were written by the same author. The other six are disputed. The letters of Paul were written during the 50s. During the 50s, in that period of the first century, nobody thought that Jesus was born to a virgin. Or Paul didn't think that was important enough to mention. It appears nowhere. Of all the four Gospels, the book of Mark was written earliest. Whoever wrote the book of Mark, if someone tells you that I know who wrote the book of Mark, they don't know what they're talking about. We don't know who wrote it. The person who wrote it does not identify himself as Mark. It was written anonymously. It's only a Christian tradition that dates to the second century, late second century, about the time of Irenaeus, the bishop of Lyon. He was actually from Turkey, but he was the bishop in what is today France. Only he will set up these are the four Gospels. But Mark is earliest chronologically. There is no mention of anything unusual about the way that Jesus was conceived in the book of Mark. Book of Mark opens with the baptism. You're going to see how important that is. Matthew and Luke are written about the same time, about the year 80, 85. Probably 15 years after the book of Mark, which was written about the time of Churban Bayit Sheni. Matthew, Luke, written about 15 years later, and there we suddenly have a claim, and that is Jesus was miraculously conceived. I want you to know that if you look at your own Bible, the miraculous conception of Jesus is there. Now, although the virgin birth of Jesus is mentioned both in Luke and Matthew. There are 89 chapters in the Gospels, okay? Only two in Matthew and two in Luke discuss any of this. Whoever wrote Matthew, again, we don't know who wrote it, but whoever authored this book intended that a Jewish audience read it. He sought to persuade Jewish people. Therefore, whereas we're told about the virgin birth in both Matthew and Luke, Luke simply tells the story, but Matthew goes one step further. Matthew says, this is not an arbitrary event that the Messiah was born to a virgin. Oh, no. Look at your own Bible. It's prophesied in your scriptures. Joseph is told by Mary that she's pregnant, even though they weren't married. She was what we call an arusa, which means she was engaged, and then suddenly discovers she's pregnant. Joseph wanted to divorce her because he knew one thing with certainty, and that is he had absolutely nothing to do with this. And while he was considering divorcing her, an angel comes to him and says, don't put away Mary, because that which is within her womb is of the Holy Spirit. And this fulfilled what was spoken of the Lord by the prophet, saying, behold, and this is the text we're very interested in right now. This is Matthew chapter 1, verse 23. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they will call his name Emmanuel, which means God is with us. Well, this is very intriguing. If you had a Christian study Bible, means a Bible with cross references, and you looked up that passage, it would cross-reference it to Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, our chapter this evening. However, when we go to Isaiah 7, verse 14, the most striking element is not there. The word virgin doesn't appear there. The Hebrew rather says, L'chein yitem Hashem hu lechem os, behold, the Lord will give you a sign. Hine ho'alma hora, behold, what is an alma? Behold, the young woman is pregnant. She's already pregnant. V'yoledes bein, and she's going to give birth to a son. V'koros shemo Emmanuel. And she, meaning the woman, will call his name Emmanuel. The church doesn't like the fact that it says she will call his name Emmanuel because Vikarat is in the feminine, but as it turns out, Mary never calls Jesus Emmanuel. He's never called Emmanuel anywhere in the Christian Bible. So the church is going to change to they will call his name Emmanuel. The critical word there is Alma. The word Alma means a young woman. Ho Alma means the young woman. There is only one way in both biblical and modern Hebrew to convey certain virginity, and that's the word betula. And that word does not appear in Isaiah 7:14. What the church did was it took the text of the Jewish scriptures. Imagine you have the word, behold, hine ho'al mahora, behold, the young woman is with the child, okay? So you imagine that's on Microsoft Word, selected. You now have white letters on a blue background. You then tap the delete key and those words disappear, and then you type in instead, behold, a virgin shall conceive. How do you change my Bible? How do you alter the Hebrew scriptures? And if you're going to do that, do you think I'm going to convert to Christianity? Do you think I'm going to get baptized, destroy my relationship with God, abandon my faith? The word Alma means a young woman. It's a rather unusual term in Tanakh, but it is used many times about women who are not virgins. In Proverbs chapter 30, verse 19 and 20, the Kein derech gever bi Alma, such is the way of a man with a woman, and the context is it's describing an adulterous woman, hardly a virgin. So by simply changing one word in the text, you suddenly have a brand new message. Moreover, as you'll see in a moment, when Isaiah is delivering this message to Ahaz, who was the king of Judah, Ahaz was an extraordinarily wicked king. It might be said that he was the most wicked of all the Davidic kings. You might suggest, well, maybe it was Menasheh, who, as it turns out, would be his grandson. But Menasheh actually repents. Menasheh does tshuva. Ahaz does not. Ahaz becomes king when he's 20 years old. For reference, Ahaz's son is Hezekiah, who's very righteous. Ahaz, the father who ruled for 16 years, from the time he was 20 till he was 36, was incredibly wicked. Ahaz's father was a man named Yotam, who also ruled for 16 years, and Yotam was an incredibly righteous king. This turns out to be a problem in the Davidic period, in the first temple period, because very often you had a king who was very righteous, you had a son who was wicked, who kind of undid what the accomplishments of his father, and then he had a righteous son, and this going back and forth would not do well for Klal Yisrael. One other point about the term Alma that's very critical is the text says, Hine ho Alma, behold the young woman. As it turns out, the church could not leave the definite article there, so it had to jettison that as well. So in Matthew chapter 1, verse 23, the text reads, behold, a virgin shall conceive, but as it turns out, the text actually says, behold, the young woman. And you just change the text, you rip the meaning out, and suddenly you have a brand new message. And Christians are not taught Hebrew. In the United States, where many of you are from, there are so many thousands of Christian schools for children, and none of them teach Hebrew to the kids. If a Christian wants to learn Hebrew, not a problem. When you go to Dallas Theological Seminary, when you go up to Fuller Theological Seminary, or you can go to Yale, or go to any, then you could take biblical Hebrew, you're already in college, it's too late. And therefore, Christians are utterly reliant on translators, utterly reliant on the King James Version, the New International Version. In fact, many Christians argue and disagree over which is the translation you should use. Don't use this translation. I use the King James. I only use the New International. I only use the New American Standard. I only use this one. Why are they arguing over translations? Go back to the original. I remember years ago debating a Christian, quite a scholar. We debated in Houston, and prior to our debate, we had this conversation, and I asked him, like, what are the kinds of questions that you get from your students? And he said one of the questions I'm asked most frequently is, which translation of the Bible do you recommend? And I asked him, what do you tell them? He said, well, it depends. If you want a more literal translation of text, maybe you would use a New American Standard. And if you want something that reads more easily, but it's not, you could use a New International. And I asked him, like, why don't you just tell him to read the original Hebrew? You could see how dangerous this is to the church. If Christians had access to the original Hebrew before they made a commitment to believe in Christianity, they would run. They would run. Christians genuinely think that Jews are insane for not believing in Jesus. I'm talking about good people genuinely think that the Jewish people are completely blind and there's a veil over their eyes and they can't see. It says that explicitly in 2 Corinthians chapter 3. How could a people who have produced so many Nobel Prize winners, how could a people that produced the very doctors that delivered my children be so dumb and thick-headed about the Messiah? How could you be so blind? And conversely, Jewish people who went to yeshiva, who learned just, and then at some point you're going, Mommy, why do they have a Christmas tree? And why is there a thing of Mary? And why do they believe these things? At some point, Jewish kids ask their parents, like, why? And then we find out what Christians believe. And we go, why would you ever believe that? And it's a very strange relationship that religious Jews and religious Christians have with each other. So we might agree on many things, whether socially, politically, and so on, but when it comes to this issue, there's almost, when we're trying to be polite on both sides, we're looking at each other in amazement. Like, why would you believe this? How could you possibly believe that you're supposed to drink and eat the body of the Messiah, whether that is meant to be understood literally as Catholics do, as Roman Catholics do, and Orthodox Christians do, or in some symbolic way. Where did you get John chapter 6? Like, what? How? Where would that ever come from? Why would you think the Messiah has to be born a virgin? Like, there's nothing remotely resembling dying, the Messiah dying for the sins of the world. Why would an innocent person die for the sins of the world? That's insane. It's like so important to us, whether you live in the United States or you live in Israel, you live in Europe. It's really important for us that courts find out who the really guilty people are and punish them and exonerate innocent people. It really would bother every single person in this room if we were to discover that there was an innocent person sitting in an American or Israeli jail. It would really bother us if we were to discover that there was a completely innocent person sitting in a British prison. We really don't want innocent people punished for the behavior of anyone else. Where do you get that from? How do you get that? And these Christians I'm meeting, they're like really nice people. This was a very striking thing to me, because growing up in Brooklyn, as a kid, I didn't think much of Christians, because I spent most of my time like running away from them. It was the amount of anti-Semitism that I observed growing up in Borough Park, Brooklyn, as a kid, was insane. Someone introduced himself to me from Borough Park. If you grew up in Borough Park in the 60s and 70s, and you had a yarmulke on your head, you were a religious Orthodox Jewish kid, and there were a bunch of non-Jews, and they were all Christians. They were all Catholic, probably, whatever they were all Christians, okay? There were no Hindus and Buddhists that I knew about, okay? We didn't see any of that, okay? There were no Zoroastrians. They were all Christian kids, okay? I mean, there was no such thing as you walk past a bunch of non-Jewish kids, and they would go, good day. Like, how are you this afternoon? That never happened. You didn't go into a schoolyard where they're playing handball and bear. You never did it, because you were lucky they would call you a Christ killer. If you were lucky, you had to avoid them. Why? Because they're I thought they were all insane. I was born 15 years after the Holocaust. All around me there were people with numbers on their arms, and it made sense because I could see how if they had the chance, they would do exactly what they did to most of my family in the spring of 1944 in Hungary. So my view of Christians as a kid was, it's not that I didn't hate them, I just thought they were insane. It's not that I sat around trying to figure out how to hurt them. I was just trying to stay safe and just stay in your Jewish neighborhood. And if you were in Borough Park, you didn't go further down like 38th Street, 30. Once you go there, then you're going, But what happens is in my 20s, I'm meeting Christians because I'm teaching, I'm lecturing, who are really nice people, who are completely sane, who are really nice folks, who express a deep love for Israel, express a deep love for the Jewish people. And I can see that many of them were very sincere. And I said, whoa, holy smokes, like, so you're normal. So then why is it? But of course, it's reading a text in this fashion. By being deprived of the original, Christians then read the Jewish Bible through a Christological grid, through a Christological filter, and by simply altering the text, changing it, suddenly you have a brand new message. And that's why we're all talking past each other. It's a real challenge when you're talking. People ask me, how is it that when I talk to a Christian, that I'm able to just, because I know what they went through. I know what they were exposed to. I know the literature that filled the marrow of their bones, that filled their minds, and that's why I'm able to, I get it. And if I had been raised reading these kinds of texts, and I didn't have the good fortune of going to yeshiva, and really good yeshivas, I'd hate me too. And I think really strange things about the Messiah. Because what they're doing is they're not bad people. What they're doing is they're just reading the Hebrew Bible through a Christological filter. And we, my friends, tonight, are going to examine this extraordinary chapter, Isaiah chapter 7, and we're going very high, through this filter. The massive problem with identifying Isaiah 7:14 as a prophecy about the Messiah born 700 years later to a virgin is astounding, because it's not just the word Alma, which means young woman, mistranslated, and the word Betula appears, the word virgin appears quite a number, handful of times in the book of Isaiah. The Tanakh has no problem using the word virgin, and virginity was something very important to Tanakh if it meant it. But this whole chapter was completely ripped out of context. Let's talk. Isaiah chapter 7, what's occurring here? We're finally being told about an event in history. As you know, those who have been with me on this journey through the book of Isaiah recognize that this is very strange for the book of Isaiah. Isaiah typically does not read this way. Isaiah here brings into view a shocking event that occurred during the prophetic career of Isaiah, which was very extensive. There was a war. The land of Israel was divided into two kingdoms. We're going back to the Assyrian Empire. We're traveling back in time about 2,750 years to a time when the largest empire that the world has ever known emerged. The Assyrian Empire was the first empire in history to actually have a full standing powerful army, and they crushed their enemies. It was during this time that also Klal Yisrael, the people of Israel, the children of Israel, were divided into two kingdoms. For those of you who are not familiar with this little piece of history, we can do this in 60 seconds. When King Solomon was Nifter, when Shlomo HaMelech died after reigning for 40 years, he had a son named Rehoboam. His son was asked by the nation of Israel, they pleaded with him that there's been a lot of projects during your father's reign, and the taxes are just very, very high. can you lower the taxes? Rehoboam asked advice from the elders of the Jewish people, and they said, listen to the people. He then asked for advice from his young friends, who told him, if essentially, if you're going to give them a finger, they're going to want a hand. And Rehoboam tragically did not listen to the sages of Israel, but rather listened to his own friends who were young like him. And he told the people, and there was a massive civil war. A man named Yeravim ben Nevat created what's called a kingdom of Israel in the northern part of Eretz Yisrael, in the northern part of the land of Israel. In fact, everything north of where we are now, we're in Jerusalem. So essentially, everything north of Jerusalem, which starts with the tribe of Benjamin, Yud and Benjamin, both their borders are right here on Jerusalem. So all the north breaks away and creates a new kingdom called the Kingdom of Israel. The only tribes that remain loyal to the southern kingdom, all Malchus Yehuda, is of course the tribe of Yehuda, and that's what we are in Yehuda, which is massive. We also have part of the tribe of Benjamin, and we also have all the tribe of Levi. The tribe of Levi is completely loyal to the southern kingdom. One caveat, so you know this, we are told in Tanakh that there were many, many Jews in the north from all the other 9.5 tribes who would deeply pained by this split and loved Yerushalayim, what's not to love, and they came south. There are many people among us who are from all 12 tribes. So we often think of there's no remnant at all of the 9.5, we'll call the 10 northern tribes, but actually we know that many of them came down and were here. And in fact, the leaders of the northern kingdom did whatever they could to prevent people in the north from coming in the south. And they built an altar in Dan, which many of you have seen, all kinds of things they did using avodah zarah, idolatry, in order to keep the two kingdoms, the kingdom of Yehuda and the kingdom of Israel, will sometimes get along, and sometimes they would go to war with each other. What is happening in the time of Ahaz is shocking. The kingdom of Israel, that means the northern kingdom, creates an alliance with Syria. At the time, the name of the king of Israel was Pekah ben Remaliahu. He reigned for a considerable amount of time, and in fact, Ahaz was only 3 years old when he became king, and 17 years later, this is all going to unfold. Pekah ben Remaliahu, the king of the northern kingdom of Israel, does not like the Assyrian Empire and forms an alliance with Syria, Damascus. And the two of them then come together to destroy the kingdom of the Malchus David, the kingdom of Yehuda, the southern kingdom, to remove Ahaz and replace him with another king. They did not want to form an alliance with Assyria. Ahaz, on the other hand, was not a person who believed in the God of Israel. We know nothing about him in Isaiah chapter 7. When I say nothing, if you just read Isaiah 7, you would not even understand like what kind of person this is until you got further on the chapter. So you would need 2 Chronicles chapter 28. You would need the book of Kings chapter 15, chapter 16, to know about what was happening here. These two kingdoms go to war against Ahaz, and Ahaz is going, I don't want to trust in God. This is a man who was so, he actually went to Damascus and copied the Mizbeach, the altar that was for idolatry, and built it on the Har HaBayit, literally, north of the Mizbeach. To place an altar that was an idolatrous altar on the Har HaBayit, not anywhere on the Har HaBayit, but north of the Mizbeach, was mind-blowing. Because if it's north of the Mizbeach, what if you go from the altar on the Temple Mount and you go north, not south, what are you going toward? The Holy of Holies. That means you're creating an altar based on the design of idol worshippers on the Temple Mount, separating the proper Mizbeach that's there and the Holy of Holies. This is how wicked this man is. This man has no interest in trusting in God. Isaiah 7 begins, Vayhi bimei Achaz, it was in the days of Achaz, the son of Yotam, the son of Uzziahu, king of Yehuda, that Ritzin, the king of Aram, that's the king of Syria, and Pekach ben Remaliahu, who was the king of Israel, went to wage war against Jerusalem, and they could not wage war with it. They could not succeed. And it was told to the house of David that you're in a lot of trouble, that these two kingdoms want to come and destroy you. This technique of kind of in the beginning of a chapter, giving you the headlines and what's going to happen, and then going back, it's like going from Genesis chapter 1, Genesis chapter 2, it sort of backs up and retells it. Here are the details, is exactly what's happening here. God sends Isaiah, prophet Yeshayahu, to go to tell Ahaz that the Almighty is going to protect you. You can ask for any sign you want. I know it doesn't look good. I know you feel very, very frightened that there are two kings that are seeking to destroy you, but I want you to know everything is going to be okay. Ask a sign. Achaz turns back to Yeshayahu and says, I don't want to ask a sign from God. It's one of the strange things in Tanakh is that righteous people very often ask for a sign from God. B'me'eda, how can I know? Abraham says that. What is he even asking? Hezekiah, as we'll see, when he is told that his terminal illness is going to be healed, Hezekiah wants a sign from God. But it's interesting that wicked people don't want signs. This is a very interesting topic. And what happens is that Isaiah turns back to Ahaz and says, why do you trouble God and trouble men? What are you talking about? Let me explain to you what's about to happen. Now, he's coming down to see Ahaz, and they meet, we're told in verse 3 of Isaiah chapter 7, not in the palace of Ahaz, but in a washer's pool. Because the Gemara sages tell us that, in fact, when Ahaz found out that Isaiah, the great prophet, there were quite a number of great prophets during this period. Hosea lived the time, Amos lived the time, Michal lived the time. When Ahaz found out that Isaiah was coming, and Isaiah is also family to Ahaz, they were first cousins once removed. He literally goes to the place where people wash clothing to try to get away. For some reason, when prophets come to meet a wicked king, they very often go to a place where the water is. Who else did that? Moses encounters. And Isaiah said to him, you don't have to worry because these two kingdoms are going to be destroyed. Now, imagine for a moment what Christians suggest, and that is this text is referring to somebody who's going to be born to a virgin 700 years later. This is what we're expected to believe. Isaiah comes to Ahaz and says, Ahaz, you have nothing to worry about. What do you mean I have nothing to worry about? I've got two massive armies that are surrounding Jerusalem. Calm down. Calm down. It's all going to be good. Let me explain to you what's going to happen. In 700 years from now, there's going to be a virgin who's going to have a little baby boy. She's going to call Manuel, and that's when you'll be saved. Nachaz must have gone and thought, thank God, Baruch Hashem, this is fantastic news. All I have to do is wait 700 years, and this big problem that I'm facing will all be done. Oh, fantastic. Of course, you all realize how silly this is. I implore Christians who are watching me now, I implore Christians who are listening to my voice right now, go back to the text. It is axiomatic that Isaiah intended that you read the first 13 passages of Isaiah chapter 7 before you read the 14th passage. And if Christians study one text that's taken out of context, that's preached to them from a pulpit, what do you expect to happen? The story makes no sense. I've got more for you. Not only that, the sign is not the birth of the child. You know, there are Christians that argue, let me phrase it this way. There are Christians that argue, they say, hey, Rabbi Singer, not so fast. The text says that God, behold, the Lord is going to give you an os, a sign. You're saying that this conception is an ordinary, natural conception, you know, a man and a woman, a mommy and a daddy. Where is your sign? What's the sign? That's no sign. Only if it's a virgin conception. Ah, that's miraculous. That's a sign. You get the argument? So as it turns out, a sign might be miraculous, but very frequently is not miraculous. But there's always one feature about an os, a sign, that you'll find everywhere in Tanakh, and that is a sign is always something that, think, a sign is always something that, it's really so simple, that you can
see.
Hello. A sign, stay with me. A sign is always something that you can see. And if you can't see it, then it is not a
sign.
It's not a sign. It's really so simple. If you can't see a virgin birth, what exactly are you seeing? Just stop and let your frontal lobe just relax. Just let your cerebellum just dance around and go, holy smokes, what would be the sign? It means, what are you seeing? No question, we'll ignore, you know, whether it's possible for some animals where you have parthenogenesis. Never been observed in humans. It surely would be a miracle if a virgin were conceived, right? But it would not qualify. It can't be a sign. It would certainly be miraculous. It would be in Tanakh. That would be a minor miracle. You don't need to know a lot about biology of a woman to know that Sarah conceiving at that age, that is way bigger a miracle than a virgin conceiving. That is really, really impossible. Little girls are born with all the eggs they're ever going to have. So in terms of the scheme of Tanakh, that would be a minor issue. But it's just not a sign because you can't see. It'll be a mo face. Certainly, it's not a sign. It just doesn't work. Like, what are you supposed to see? What is when we open up the Torah, what's the first signs that we encounter in the Torah? Can anyone tell me? Famous sign we see? Rainbow. Rainbow is used in Genesis to convey that God shows a sign to the world that God will never bring another flood. Is there anything miraculous about a rainbow? Nothing. Water particles in the atmosphere, light, white light, refracting through the water particles, bouncing around, coming into your eyes, and you then see the colors. That's all. No miracle, but it sure is a sign. So a sign always is something that you can see. A virgin birth just wouldn't even work. What would you see? What? Answer. Nothing. Okay, kidding. So Kindlach, we're taking off now. What then is the sign? The sign is not the conception of the child. What people fail to read is the two verses that follow. Isaiah chapter 7, verse 15. Butter and honey will the child eat when he knows to reject evil and choose good, because before he knows to reject evil and choose good, these two kings who you dread, who you're petrified, will be utterly destroyed. The sign is not the birth of the child. The sign is not the conception of the child. The sign is rather the maturity of the child. Butter and honey will the child eat when he knows to reject bad and choose good. Okay, let's think about this. You're in siege. Jerusalem is surrounded, surrounded by Syria in the north and the kingdom of Israel in the north as well. You're in an enormous amount of trouble. You're under siege. You're not eating butter and honey under siege. So the child will eating butter and honey, which means you're doing fine now. When the child knows to reject evil and choose good, that means he's just barely maturing, and these two kings will abandon this land. They'll be destroyed. And in 2 Kings chapter 15 and 16, Pekah ben Remaliahu is assassinated. Ritzin is done with. They're both assassinated. They're all gone. So the sign is not the conception or birth of the child. The sign is when the child will mature. That means by the time the child knows the difference between good and evil, right and wrong, at whatever age you want to put that, that you'll already be free. It's the maturity of the child. What question should you be asking now? If that's the case, then why tell me this whole speech about, behold, the young woman is with a child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel? Why do I need that passage for? Why do I need that information? See, Yeshayahu is very, very delicious. Every word, yedishtit and trit, every element about these texts is so intense. Why does Isaiah tell us that that a woman is with a child and she's going to have a child, a baby, and the child's name is Emmanuel? Why is this important? Moreover, when Isaiah went down, in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 3, we're going a little early on the chapter, when Isaiah comes to visit Ahaz, he comes with his son, and his son's name is Shar-Yashuv. And when Isaiah says, behold, the young woman, he's talking to the mommy of Shar-Yashuv, his own kid. This name, Shar-Yashuv, this child is never mentioned anywhere else in Tanakh. Why did Isaiah put it in there? Why do I need to know about a child named Shar-Yashuv? Because what does Shar-Yashuv mean? Those who, say it louder. Right. Right, those who return, they'll be preserved. That means the names of the child are what matter here. Names are really important in Tanakh. So bring Shar-Yashuv as a sign to Ahaz that this remnant is going to be protected. The purpose of Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14 is to tell us, Emmanuel, that God is with you. Now, that's not going to be the case for the northern kingdom of Israel. They're going to face destruction. And under the great tragedy is, Ahaz is bringing in the Assyrian Empire as an ally, and at first it really works. But ultimately the Assyrian Empire is going to, when you start making treaties with your enemies and peace treaties with those who want to destroy you, they get settled in and they finally come and destroy. And it's that same Assyria that's going to carry off the 10 northern tribes. We're going to read about them the next time we're together in Isaiah chapter 9 and chapter 10. Catastrophic event that occurred in Isaiah's own lifetime. So the sign is the maturity of the child, not the birth of the child. Why then am I told about the birth of the child? Because of the name. Because the name is Emmanuel, which means God is with you. That means it's with the kingdom of Judah. You'll be protected. You will not be destroyed like what is going to happen to the northern kingdom of Israel. What's going to happen to Syria? We're going to go a little higher. Dial this up. Just sort of deep breath here. Isaiah chapter 8, verse 3. Isaiah says, V'ekrav el hanaviyah. What does V'ekrav el hanaviyah mean? It's such a rare word in Tanakh. In fact, that structure only appears two times in all of Tanakh. Now, the root you will recognize, come close. But V'ekrav literally is describing sexual intimacy. That exact word only appears in one other place in Tanakh, and that's in Deuteronomy chapter 22, verse 14, where a man had sexual intercourse with a woman, and then he claims that she's really not a virgin, and so on. But the point of that term is to convey sexual intimacy. Now, you know that very often it says, and he, a man from Levi, knew a woman from Levi, and they had a baby. That's normal. Like, why are you doing this? Why are you telling me? So imagine, yeah, this is quite a shidduch. Yeshayahu was a Navi. Of the period, he was one of the giants in Jewish history. His wife, this is a Beis Yaakov girl, Val Victorian, he's married to a Neviah. He's married to a prophetess. And then he comes to tell us that I went and was intimate. There's some translations that said, I literally, I made love to her, I was intimate. Do you have to translate it that way? And then she conceives and bears a son, and God tells Isaiah, look, this is what I want you to call the kid's name. Maher Shalal Hashbaz, quicken the loot, hasten the booty. That's what I want you to call the kid's name. And if you want to know who this kid is, it's the same kid as Emmanuel. Right, this should shock you. This is Emmanuel. Remember, in Isaiah 7:14, who is told to name the child Emmanuel? Who is given that mandate? The wife. God now says to Isaiah, look, here's what I want you to do. I want you to call the kid's name, hasten the plunder, quicken the booty. And in case you think I'm pulling stuff out of air, in case you think, well, how do you know what I'm telling you is true? This is fantastic. Verse 4, for before the child knows how to say daddy, mommy, the wealth of Damascus and the spoils of Samaria will be carried off before the king of Assyria. It's the exact same prophecy, and that is that it is the maturity of the child. How old is a child when a child knows to say mommy, daddy? About how old? 2 years, a little younger, a little later, right? So before the child can know to say mommy, daddy, these two kings will be destroyed. It's the exact same sign, it's the exact same kingdoms that threaten you, and it's the exact same delivery. This is the same child. Why then, my friends, if you can do this for me, we're going further now, we're going higher now. Why then, answer this question, did Isaiah say, V'ekrav el Nevi'a? Why did he spell it out so graphically that he was having intimate relations with his wife? Answer that question. Was Isaiah speaking to his generation for that? What is he conveying? Just know that this relationship is sexual intercourse. There's no virgin here. This text is stunning. I want to go a little further with you. I want to press this a little further. I want to just go a little higher now. We're going now very, very high. Going very high. The names of children are very important. In fact, we're told in Isaiah chapter 8, verse 18, Isaiah says that the reason that God gave me children is for signs and wonders, for signs for the Jewish people, as a portent of the nation of Israel. So we have Isaiah, who has a child named Shayoshev, Emmanuel, quicken the loot, hasten the booty. These are signs that God is going to preserve the kingdom of Judah. What other prophet lived at the exact same time? I mentioned it earlier to you. At that exact time, who was Isaiah's contemporary, who's a very famous Navi? Well, there are quite a few of them, but there's one, if you talk about the names of children, you should be thinking about. Bingo, Hosea, Hosea. Hosea lived the exact same time. However, whereas Isaiah lived in the, was preaching primarily to the southern kingdom of Yehuda, Hosea was in the north, and he was preaching to a doomed people, the kingdom of Israel. How does the book of Hosea begin? We're going very high now. He says, now Isaiah marries who? A Navi, a Neviah. Hosea is told to marry a prostitute. That is not a shidduch for a Navi. Wait, you're having kids. Let me tell you about the names of those kids. I'm not going to have mercy on you. You are not my people. You will not be seated. Bingo. So we have two Nevi'im at the exact same time. One preaching in the north to a doomed northern kingdom whose wife a prostitute, therefore, is a symbol of the prostitution of the northern kingdom of Israel. They were unfaithful, disloyal to the God of Israel. And a prophet in the south who's married to a Neviah, a very holy woman. Different destiny. Oh, you're both going to have kids, but they're going to have really different names. One set of children are going to be portents of doom, that God is going to destroy the northern kingdom. And you in the south, Emmanuel, Shar Yashuv, quicken the loot, hasten the booty. Bingo. You see how big these names are. Listen, Kindlech, like you've never listened in your life. Why are we told this story in the book of Isaiah? How is this relevant to us? One of the things I shared with you right from the get-go as we were studying Isaiah together is that texts that are telling you what you're doing wrong and are using this very poetic language are difficult to understand, but the advantage to them is that you get the message. Why do we encounter this story of Isaiah chapter 7 and 8, which is about the deliverance of Ahaz? Because even though Ahaz didn't deserve to be saved from the northern kingdom of Israel and Syria, but he was, after all, the house of David. He was the house of Yehuda. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God made a promise to King David called a Davidic covenant, 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 12 through 16, that nothing could happen to you. Ahaz did not deserve to be delivered. It was not because of his own merit. He was delivered because of a promise that he made to his great-great-grandfather. The Davidic dynasty cannot be destroyed. That's a Davidic covenant. So God is delivering Ahaz in Isaiah chapter 7 and 8. Why do I need to know this story? It gets more interesting. Isaiah 9 and 10, that's not tonight, that's the next time we're together, is about who? About Chizkiyahu, Hezekiah. I alluded to that earlier. Hezekiah is king of Malchus Yehuda for the kingdom of Judah for 29 years. During that period, it is now Sanherib that comes to destroy the northern kingdom. He wants to destroy Yerushalayim as well. And Hezekiah is a total tzaddik. In fact, in 2 Kings chapter 18, we're told that Hezekiah was the greatest tzaddik of all the Davidic kings before him and that would follow him. And Hezekiah would tell the nation to turn to God. And now when you say the nation, that means everybody in Yerushalayim. It means everything else, all the rest of Yehuda is destroyed, more than 40 cities. The northern kingdom has completely been destroyed in three waves. And Chizkiyahu turns to God. He goes into the Beis HaMikdash in the temple and throws himself down before God and asks for deliverance. And how is Chizkiyahu and his people delivered? How is Yerushalayim delivered? In the 14th year of his reign, one night, it was a Passover evening. You finished the Passover Seder, and you went to sleep after eating the Passover lamb and the matzahs, myrrh, and so on. And you probably didn't think you had many days left to live, because you can hear the clamor of the Assyrian army around the walls. And the nation turns to God, and they're delivered with a great miracle. They wake up on the first day of Pesach, on the morning of the 15th, and Moshe, Shlemi, Chava, do you hear that? Do you hear what? There's nothing. There's 185,000 Assyrian soldiers. Why? I don't hear a sound. Let's look. People climb over to look over the top of the wall that's around Yerushalayim, and they're all dead. Miraculously, God saves the kingdom of Judah with Chizkiyahu. What do we have in view here? Why is Isaiah doing this? Oh, by the way, to get really yummy, to really go holy, what's Isaiah 11? Mashiach. Okay? So again, because we're going now, because what I wanted to do with you is I want to understand what's really going on here. Isaiah chapter 7 and 8 is a picture of the kingdom of Yehuda, of Judah, threatened, but a very wicked king. but God delivers them. How? If I asked most of you how Pekach and Ritzin were removed, you probably wouldn't even know. It's very unremarkable. But God keeps his promise. And that's what happens to a Dor Chayev, to a guilty generation, but God has to deliver them. But what happens if you have a Dor Zakai? What happens if you have a righteous generation? What happens if you have a righteous people? Then God delivers you with great miracles and wonders. And that's what comes of you. Ah, now you see the two ways that Mashiach can come. Either because the nation, God has to deliver you, and therefore he creates such an amazing scenario that you have no choice but to turn to God, or you have a king like Chizkiyahu that turns you to God, you're going to get delivered. But it's either Be'itai or Acheshena, Isaiah chapter 60, last passage. It's either going to be in this time or I'm going to hasten it. It's either going to happen in a way that's natural and a way that's completely miraculous. Either the third temple, the final temple, is going to be built just coming down from heaven, or it's going to be built by hands. But it's going to happen because the God of Israel keeps his promise. So what Isaiah always has in view is the redemption, the final redemption. But he presents us in a marvelous way with every element, every angle, so you understand, Ken Lach, this is how to relate to Hashem. This is God's promise to you. This is how he will deliver you. I want to give you a complete picture of Mashiach. Okay, you got Isaiah 7 and 8? You got the names of the kids? You got what kind of wife that is? You got Isaiah chapter 9 and 10? You got about what kind of king that is? Bingo, let's talk about Mashiach, Isaiah chapter 11. Johnny, Elisheva, thank you so much for making me come.
Adon Olam, Asher Malach, B'terem Kol, Yetzir Nivra, Le'et Nasa.